Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings and welcome to the ID the Future podcast. This is Casey Luskin, broadcasting with Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture in Seattle, Washington. Today again, we have on the show with us Dr. Angus Manouge, professor of philosophy at Concordia University, and he was recently on a show with us talking about some of his interest in the debate over intelligent design and evolution from the perspective of both a computer programmer and somebody who studies the function and philosophy of mind. And Dr. Manouge talked with us about some of his ideas about how intelligent design provides a better account of the human mind than many other Darwinian materialistic explanations. But Dr. Manouge, I'd like to talk with you today about some of your more recent research. So could you briefly talk to us about what does your latest research deal with?
Well, three main topics. For several years, I've been developing a refutation of the case for methodological materialism. Methodological materialism is the idea that within science, you can only ever cite undirected causes, chance or natural law. You can never cite goal-directed causes. And there are lots of reasons that, you know, people bring up to defend that point of view, such as the God of the Gaps argument. So I've been doing work rebutting all of those arguments that are used to defend methodological materialism. Another one that's related to that is a defense of what's called downward mental causation, which is the idea that the mind isn't just passively generated by the brain, but can actually act back on the brain. How's that possible, given that some philosophers, you know, believe in this thing called the causal closure of the physical, that says that any physical effect must have a completely sufficient physical cause so that the mind's got nothing to do, it's out of a job. I refute that idea. And also look at the very exciting scientific evidence coming from workers in neuroscience, such as, of course, Jeff Schwartz and Mario Beauregard and many others, that actually provides some good hard evidence that the mind is capable of reshaping the brain, neuroplasticity, and also the role of mental attitude in health. This fascinating field, psychoneuroimmunology, which is about how what goes on in the mind affects the brain and hence the immune system. One other thing that's very new, trying to come up with a theory of information that's not materialist, that accounts for the creativity of agents such as human beings.
Now, this may sound like a simplistic question, but explain to us my models of mind-brain interaction where the brain can actually affect its own physical structure are more consistent with an ID model of the brain rather than a materialistic or Darwinian model of the brain.
Well, we're seeing in work by neuroscientists like Jeff Schwartz and Mario Beauregard is basically directed agent causation, this downward causation. For example, in Schwartz's original work on obsessive compulsive disorder, the key to his therapy to break that condition is deliberate conscious attention on alternative behavior. In other words, it's the work of the mind that breaks down this OCD circuit in the brain. And, you know, he and Beauregard have shown lots of cognitive therapies that work in that way. And in all of those cases, the most reasonable interpretation is that this is goal-directed causation. It's the mind influencing the brain. It very much fits with the idea in intelligent design that you have a directed cause with a goal.
Okay, so what are some of the practical implications and applications of your new research?
Well, on the refuting methodological materialism, there I'm trying to do what I can to open up science and science education to a plurality of views to compete rather than this Darwin-only approach. It seems to me that this has become increasingly silly when you see that there are working medical therapies that are incompatible with materialism, and yet major science organizations are saying that materialism is somehow definitive of the scientific method. So I think that needs to be opened up. On the mind-body causation, I think it's very important to defend people's responsibility and dignity. We're not just passive objects. We're not like a a lamp, if it's broken, you fix it or you leave it on the street. No, we have some ability to take charge of our lives. And the most exciting example of that right now is in patient-directed care, where they have discovered that those patients who really take charge of the healing process and involve their own mental attitudes, that makes a huge difference.
Mm.
All kinds of illness, including, you know, people recovering from cancer and all the rest of it. So that's extremely important, I think, for public health. And then for the non-materialist theory of information, I'm really trying to defend the creativity of agents, that we're not just machines who can just crank things out that are already in our input or in our program, but there is an ability to discover new information.
Now, what about this origin of new information? Can new biological information be generated by the Darwinian mechanism, or is there a requirement that there's an intelligent agent involved?
I suppose that the Darwinian approach could develop a few fragments. I mean, in the sense that when you look at these, you know, simulators of millions of monkeys and all the rest of it, that they might be able to come up with the equivalent of words or phrases, but that won't be enough to develop a library of instructions that you need in a genome or something like that. So very, very modest. It seems to me you don't get the enough information or the kind of information that you need to get from one body plan to another, or from one functional protein machine to another, and that's what they would need to defend their view. And the reason is that the information that specifies body plans or protein machines basically resides in highly isolated islands in a sea of non-function. Michael Denton saw this. In his book, Evolution, the Theory of Crisis, he said, in the case of every kind of complex functional system, the total space of all combinatorial possibilities is so nearly infinite, and the isolation of meaningful systems so intense, it would be truly a miracle to find one by chance. And even Richard Dawkins, in the Ancestor's Tale, admits that living creatures are islands of viability separated from other islands by gigantic oceans of grotesque deformity. And so, as he admits, the problem is if you try to move from one to another, you're the most likely to end up in the ocean where nothing can live. And it's played out again even at the molecular level, where, you know, the work of Douglas Sachs shows that multiple amino acid substitutions inevitably result in loss of protein function. And again, this is Stephen Meyer reporting on it. Functional proteins represent highly isolated and improbable arrangements of amino acids. I think it's intelligent that can find needles in haystack, tiny islands in a huge sea where the other stuff doesn't work or it's no good.
That's a very, very clear explanation, Dr. Mnuz. Thank you for that. I'd like to change the topic a little bit right now. You recently had a debate with P.Z. Myers. And I guess, does any of this tie into that debate? And can you tell us a little bit about how the debate went?
Yeah, it ties in because it all had to do really with the power of the mind. Whether neuroscience leaves room for God was the key theme, because right now, atheist scientists are attempting to discredit religious belief by saying that it all arises from some spot or area in the brain. So you have the idea of Dean Hamer's the God gene or the God spot, or maybe it's the result of temporal lobe epilepsy, and Michael Persinger's odd experiments up in Canada with the God helmet to try and induce religious experience. That's what's going on right now. And, you know, none of it works, because the neuroscientists have started to test these things. Andrew Newberg and Beauregard. And they've shown that no single part of the brain is involved in religious experiences. They're just as distributed as any other rational experience. And also, that they're very widespread in the human population, much more than atheism is, for example. And so really, they ought to be presumed psychologically normal, not, you know, something bizarre as if religious believers are ill and that their thinking needs to be explained away. So that was part of it. And then I also, in the process of the debate, attacked materialism by presenting some philosophical and scientific arguments. I point out that modern science depended on theological assumptions, I gave the argument from reason that materialism is really incompatible with human rationality. I point out that consciousness doesn't reduce to physical causes. And I cited, of course, all of this work from people like Schwartz and Beauregard showing the power of the mind over the brain, because, you know, Meyer's view is that the mind is just generated by the brain and doesn't really do anything. He really is a hardcore materialist. Now, and it's fascinating, too, with all this study, you'll notice that there are almost no studies of the brains of atheists. Isn't it interesting that they want to focus this on certain kinds of religious believers?
You know, this is such a common thing. We almost need to come up with a term for this bias towards studying religion, but there's no interest in studying atheism. It's just assumed to be the result of pure logic, which evolved to help us survive. Whereas, you know, religion, they have to go through these long, arduous explanations of why the brain is, you know, interested in it and so forth. I mean, we've got to come up with a term for this inherent research bias that reveals so much underlying, it reveals so much about the biases and the assumptions that they come to the table with. I don't know if there's a good term yet or not for the bias to study religion but not atheism, but I think somebody should come up with one. So maybe something for you to think about.
Okay.
I'm not interested in getting into the yucky gutter of this debate at all, but my experience unfortunately has taught that anyone who opposes P.Z. Myers is soon thereafter nailed up on his blog for his followers to throw tomatoes at. So did you experience much in the way of personal attacks in the wake of your debate with P.Z. Myers?
Not after the debate. In my case, you know, there seemed to be silence, and people I know at Morris say that this is most unusual. He usually takes people to task and they get attacked all over the place by his disciples. That the only thing that he did, a little obnoxious before the debate, he posted some condescending material about me and some inaccurate claims. He said that I was a fellow of the Discovery Institute. You know, I wish that were true, but it's not. And also the recycled insult that I resemble Mr. Bean, you know.
I don't think that's an insult. I'm a huge Mr. Bean fan, so I think I would not take that as an insult,
right,
having actually received that accusation myself a couple times. So I absolutely think you should wear that badge proudly, in my opinion.
Well, I don't take lifts from people who drive three-wheel vehicles. I mean, he's right about that.
Fair enough. Well, that's good. I'm glad you don't do that. I don't want to make any of this personal. So on a more objective level, what did you think of PZ's arguments against you in the debate?
Well, it was kind of a depressing poll in the room during his presentation, because he focused almost all of it on how brain deficits, age, and illness could impair psychological function.
You're kidding me.
We all know what's that now?
You're telling me that illness can affect brain function. You've got to be kidding me.
Yeah, I mean, this is all stuff that everybody knows, but it was based on, you know, the bottom-up account. He was basically trying to give examples where the mind isn't working very well because of something in the brain, and that creates the impression that, well, maybe everything in the mind is passively generated by the brain, so the mind doesn't really do anything. It's
okay.
An phenomenon. And then the other part of his argument was to suggest, well, science can't possibly support God in any way because God is not physically measurable. So in dealing with his views, first of all, with the idea that the brain just throws up the mind passively, I gave the analogy of a phone. If someone's speaking to you on the phone and then you drop the phone so it's broken, you can't hear them anymore. But no one says that the phone generated their voice. It's rather the phone transmits their voice. And it seems to me that the idea of the brain as a transmitter, it receives information from the environment and then it transmits our thoughts and desires in various ways, is really a better model. And so, of course, yeah, brain damage will really spoil day and it will affect your ability to think. But that doesn't mean that the brain simply generates all of our thoughts passively. Then I also focused on this attempt to debunk religion and point out it was the genetic fallacy, basically trying to discredit religious beliefs by saying where in the brain they come from. But, of course, that's got nothing to do with whether they're true or false.
Sure, absolutely.
The example I gave is, suppose you don't like mathematicians, you do brain scans, and you find out there's all kinds of weird things going on in mathematicians' brains when they do math. Probably true. But would that show that their theorems were false? Obviously not. What matters is the correspondence of people's ideas to, you know, the real world, sure. not what's going on in their brain.
I'm interrupting you. I mean, again, the argument, why don't Darwinists ever study the brains of Darwinists and say, when they're thinking about Darwinian evolution, looking at what is going on in their brains? No one's ever done an experiment like that. Again, it's just this bias that, you know, their view is the result of pure logic, so they have to study everyone else's view and try to explain it away. But I'm sure that you could find some kind of a phenomenon going on in the minds of Darwinist bloggers who are calling you names and comparing you to Mr. Bean. But does that mean that you, that doesn't have any bearing on whether or not you actually do resemble Mr. Bean? I mean, let's just be honest here. So,
right.
Continue on.
Well, no, I mean, and the other thing was just saying that science couldn't produce any evidence for God because God's not measurable. Of course, though, science employs lots of notions that aren't measurable. Truth, logic, numbers, you can't observe those. We postulate forces, elementary particles that we can't at least directly observe, black holes, dark matter, strings. And of course, the materialist's favorite way to get out of fine-tuning is to postulate necessarily unknowable and unobservable universes,
yes.
extra universes that by definition no one could observe. So I think it's quite an incredible claim to say that, you know, people's thought should be restricted to what we can directly observe.
Absolutely. Well, if you were given the opportunity to do the debate over again, would you do it?
I said to him at the end that what I thought would be more profitable would be to build it up and have several people on each side, you know. And in my fantasy casting for this, if it could be me and the philosopher William Lane Craig, and then Jeff Schwartz and Mario Beauregard on one side, and then if it were P.Z. Myers and three people, perhaps Daniel Dennett, Richard Dawkins, and someone else on the other side, I think that would be better because more of the issues would come out. But, you know, I find it's ironic that materialists seem to be shy of too much engagement. I guess I should be glad that I had the debate that I did.
Very true, very true. Well, I think my final question is, why haven't we had you on the podcast earlier, Dr. Manoj? You study some absolutely fascinating topics that are so core to this debate, and you have such a clear and compelling way of discussing these issues that it's just been an absolute pleasure interviewing you.
Oh, well, thank you. I don't really know the answer to your question beyond that. I am really a traditional academic in many ways. You know, so I suppose I'm a bit of an outsider. I'm a bit of a recluse. I spend most of my time doing stuff that requires an awful lot of concentration, but I've come to realize the responsibility to go out there in the public square, mainly if the people who are troubled by what the materialists are saying and don't know how to answer it. So that's kind of been a change this last year. I did probably 20 presentations around the country on various things. So anyway, but I'm very happy to have this opportunity to be on your podcast.
Well, we appreciate you coming on, and you clearly have a gift for explaining things in very clear terms. So thank you very much for sharing your time and your wisdom with us, Dr. Manoj. We'd love to have you on again and keep us updated about your research.
All right. Thank you very much, Casey.
Thank you again. This is Casey Luskin with the ID the Future podcast, signing off. Thanks for listening.
Music on ID the Future comes courtesy of composer Yuri Mamchur. Visit www.yuriproductions.com. And check out his latest CD, In the Harbor. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Discovery President is Bruce Chapman. ID the Future Managing Editor is Robert Crowther. And the producer is Keith Bennett. ID the Future and ID Science in the News is copyright Discovery Institute 2006. For more information, visit www.discovery.org or www.idthefuture.com.